Gaza. They've broken it nearly 1,000 times. They've bombed women, when children, tents. They haven't allowed tents to come in. So their plan is to starve and kill the Palestinians. They show the facade, and that whole Donald Trump peace summit that invited Indonesian Prime Minister, President, and heads of other states was just for show. It was just an illusion, a control of the narrative to make the people around the world think there is some kind of a peace. But in reality, it was the slow genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza.
Right, I want to focus on the accusations of breach by the Israeli forces now, Mick. What specific obligations does Hamas claim Israel has disregarded?
I'm not sure of the detail of this, but one of them was to withdraw. And now we hear the head of the military saying that they will entrench themselves on the yellow line and not give up an inch of it. As your other guest says, there's a long history of Israel showing that for them to sign a deal means absolutely nothing if in the balance of power shifts in their direction. So there are other commitments as well to release Palestinian prisoners and so on. But Israel can never be trusted to follow any of those. And the statement from the head of the military that they are going to say are going to see the yellow line as a new border is not just a violation of what was signed. It's so obvious, it's undeniable. It cannot be seen as anything else by any sensible person. But that's what Israel is doing. For them, it's always been that might equals right, that if they have the power to do something, to violate, to assault, to attack, to dispossess, they will do so in their own, you know, in their own time. They're very alert to international pressure, real pressure, and if that were to come from America, then they would desist. But they think they've got a green light from Trump at the moment, and they think that they can do this, and that's why they've done it. So the Hamas complaint is absolutely valid. It's valid 100 times over. But language is the language that we use in this program. Words mean what they mean. Ceasefire means ceasefire. You stop killing. But in the Israeli parlance, ceasefire means continue the killing in a particular way, and you'll get away with it. And violation of the agreement, they will never accept that they violated the agreement. But for them, Golda Meir and Ben Gurion from the very beginning said that, you know, the only constraint on the expansion of Israel was the balance of power at a particular moment, and that what they said, Jews, i.e. Zionist Jews, will occupy whatever they want when they want. That's what we are seeing now in real time.
Indeed. Well, Reza, Mick just pointed out the fact that the Yellow Line Declaration was a huge bridge. How significant do you believe this declaration is as a proof of Israel's non-compliance with the ceasefire?
I mean, Israel doesn't need evidence to prove that it's non-compliance with any ceasefire. But in this case, the fact that they are occupying an occupied land, so in the sense that Gaza itself was previously occupied, they withdrew from it, and now they're occupying it again, and they're using this occupation as a method to cleanse the area that they've occupied, which is called the Yellow Area, and push the remaining Palestinians into the area which is not fertile. The land, the Yellow Area that they are occupying, is the most fertile part of Gaza, and they're trying to starve the Palestinians slowly, or kill them, or shoot them, or have them put onto flights, taken away to different parts of the world, or pushed into Egypt, or whatever they can. So for them, the process, the aim is to cleanse that area of Palestinians. The process has changed. Before, it was a year or two of complete bombing and snipering and killing and burying alive people, Palestinians. Now it's on a slower pace. It's like as if someone's cooking something. Instead of trying to get it done quickly in the microwave, they put it on a slow cook. So the Israelis have, and the only pressure that they understand is the pressure of force. And with America's support and European support, it's very difficult for them to realize, for any country to put pressure on them to abide by any ceasefire.
Right, Mick, the most obvious result of any ceasefire must be, of course, a cease of fire. And the cessation of killings is something the least that any party needs to be able to count on. But what should Hamas do right now? Should Hamas be looking for a ceasefire within a ceasefire? You know, doesn't this make the entire deal so ridiculous?
Hamas are in a very difficult situation. The Israelis certainly started the spike in genocide 2 years ago by saying that they would drive Hamas out of the whole of Gaza. Hamas would be obliterated and destroyed. That hasn't happened. But the overwhelming power, the 2,000-pound bombs that Israel can drop on Gaza, the equivalent of all the atom bombs of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and more, means that Hamas has suffered terribly. Now, every colonial struggle, anti-colonial struggle, the people fighting suffer terribly. But in this occasion, it's really almost without precedent in the history of the human race. So Hamas is in a very, very difficult situation. They don't have allies in many of the Arab countries across the region. They're in Trump's pocket, and some of them are working with Israel under the table. So they're very vulnerable. The only hope that Hamas have, I mean, their courage, their determination. I'm saying things which in Britain will get me arrested, but who cares? The courage and heroism of the Palestinian resistance, specifically of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, is almost without equal in human history as well. But they are now alone. The Hezbollah has been weakened in Lebanon. They're still fighting. Israel hasn't won the fight, but they have weakened the opposition. So they don't have a lot of choices. I think they have to accept some kind of ceasefire. But really, they have to hold on until a wave of resistance comes to their support. And that means across the region and across the whole world, including America, Britain, Europe, and so on. Our own government is jailing thousands of people or charging thousands of people with terrorism for trying to support the Palestinians. It's a fight now between worldwide public opinion, which can it be channeled in time, and the disappearance of the Palestinians, abandoned by the collective West and by many of these Arab regimes. They don't have a lot of options.
Right, Reza. The other demand from phase one was, of course, the opening of the crossings. I think it was yesterday or the day before that the Israelis said, we are willing to open the Rafah crossing only for the Palestinians to exit the territory with no return. So, you know, how could this happen under a ceasefire? What are the mediators doing right now?
Well, this just supports my argument that this is a slow ethnic cleansing compared to the faster ethnic cleansing before the ceasefire. And my colleague in Scotland, he just demonstrated that the fact that you are not able to condemn the genociders and praise or support those resisting genocide in a free democratic country explains why they're able to close the Rafah border, why they're able to kill people, innocent people, fear of justice. You have a prime minister, for goodness sake, who has a court order against him that needs to be brought to the International Court of Justice, and he's going around the world and doing what he wants. I mean, when you have some that situation like that, they can do whatever they're literally doing whatever they want. They close the Rafah border, they'll kill anyone that goes into the sea, into the Mediterranean from the Gaza, bury people alive. They don't allow journalists in. They're the third, three years in a row now, the most killers of journalists is Israel. But no one's talking about this in Western media. The narrative doesn't come out. No one in Western legacy media discusses it. We have to discuss it on Press TV. We have to discuss it maybe on RT or the podcasts which are resisting the legacy media. So the fact that the politics and the media support the ethnic cleansing, they're able to get away with closing the Rafah border and other crimes, war crimes.
Well, of course, Mick, the human situation is indeed grave in Gaza right now, all over Palestine. Do you believe that now humanitarian guarantees should be prioritized over political negotiations in any future negotiation?
I think in Gaza, in Palestine, and really in any consideration, humanitarian and political considerations are inseparable, because the only way that humanitarian aid will reach the violated people of Gaza is by a political pressure coming through Western governments, from public opinion, and also Arab populations as well, to make their feelings known, to demand that humanitarian aid be allowed through. There's no doubt at all that if the pressure is great enough, the aid will go through. But it's a political issue, and it can only be resolved in the short term politically and in the long term politically as well. Look, Gaza, I read a few months ago, Gaza has the highest rate of child amputees, not just in war, but in human history. The gravity of the situation defies our ability to find the language to describe it, but facts like that help. The merciless barbarism of the Israelis filming their own crimes is a level of impunity that we didn't even see in Vietnam or Algeria or anywhere else. So the impunity stems from the fact that Western governments ally actively with Israel and against any notion of Palestinian freedom and justice and human rights. I mean, we've never seen an example. We've seen terrible crimes committed by the collective West for the last 500 years, genocide after genocide, huge genocides, bigger than the current one. What we haven't seen is this happening in the public view, and Western governments, knowing that public opinion is opposed to this, nonetheless pushing the sale of arms and diplomatic protection to Netanyahu and the genocidal state. That impunity comes down to grassroots level in the Israeli army, and that's why they feel able to film themselves committing these terrible crimes. So if you think about it, one other thing, the late unlamented humanitarian foundation, which the Americans and the Israelis forced, that was run by a substantial part by a motorcycle gang. Really, motorcycle gang members were recruited in America at a very high daily rate and sent to snipe Palestinians queuing up for food and bread. That level of impunity is what needs to be tackled, and it's a fight between not just the heroic resistance of Palestine against the Zionist project, but all around the world it's a fight between public opinion and pro-Israeli governments.
Right, Reza, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the role of the US here. The US, of course, played a lot of publicity and propaganda over the peace deal with the Cairo summit and everything. And at the same time, now President Trump seems to be a little detached from reality when commenting on the situation here, always talking of a wonderful peace that is holding in Gaza. And what is the responsibility of the US right now in all of this?
Well, the United States is led by a president who has the attention of a five-year-old. It was at that time it suited him to show that he's brought this peace for the Palestinians. And then once he got what he wanted, the media narrative spin on it, he's moved on to something else. He's focused on Venezuela. Now he's trying to bring some kind of a peace in between Ukraine and Russia. And he jumps to different things. There's no doubt that this President Trump has been the most supportive of the genocidal attempts by Israel. And there's no doubt that, as Ayatollah Khamenei has said many times, that Israel is not a state like normal other states. It's a colonial outpost for the United States and the European. When you look at the ethnic makeup of these Israelis that live there, majority of them come from Europe. Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and the United States, and countries like this. So America, it's part of the American policy to support Israel as much as possible. And that's why it's going to be very difficult to get peace. However, I do want to make a point that my colleague Mick raised in Scotland. If the Arabs and the countries around Israel, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and these other countries, stop supporting directly and indirectly Israel, it would make the task of the resistance much easier to defend themselves.
Right, and one final question, Mick. Of course, as you said, the situation is very precarious right now. Do you believe external mediators can now bridge the gap between Hamas's demands and the Israeli stance?
That doesn't depend on what's written on paper, because if that were to be enforced, then the Hamas minimal positions would be met, and they would have a stable the possibility of a stable ceasefire. What needs to be done in order to bridge the gap is pressure needs to be put on Israel. If Trump picked up the phone and said, I want my Nobel Peace Prize, I demand that you commit to X, Y, and Z, it would happen. Netanyahu could not possibly stand against Trump. We saw that a few months ago when he did want his Nobel Peace Prize. And when Netanyahu went to Washington and sat beside Donald Trump, I watched that scene and I thought, really, he should have been sitting on Donald Trump's knee, because it was quite clear what the power relationship was between the two. And that's still the case. If America or even Europe decided to vigorously challenge Israel, then a real ceasefire could be achieved. But at the moment, all that Netanyahu sees is a bright green light to carry on with everything that he's been doing for 2 years. I mean, we have to remind ourselves what he's been doing for 2 years. It's unspeakable, and that tells us all we need to know about the current situation. Pressure needs to be, the threat of sanctions from the governments need to be raised against Israel in order for them to be brought to heel. They're an attack dog for the West, and an attack dog sometimes bites its master, but ultimately the master has the power if they choose to use it.
It was indeed a pleasure to talk to you, gentlemen, and I wish I could continue the conversation with you for longer, but for the timing purposes, we have to end this right now. Reza Vedari, academic researcher and author, joining us from London, and Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joining us from Glasgow. And one final comment, the truth will always come out. Whether you stand with it or not is what really matters. I am Bahman Roy.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Movement.
Speed.
Living hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to this episode of Youth Station. My name is Muhammad, and I am here with Sister...
This is Nahid, having the honor of being with you.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
So
it's a very interesting topic today, and I'll begin this with this statement. If you don't like it, throw it away. If you see that someone is taunting you, delete them. Just block the page. Don't fix relationship. It's not fixable. Right? This is something that we youths are very much acquainted with. Yeah? The throwaway culture. And I think this is because we have abundance of, you know, consumables with us. And it's very cheap for us. It's not like before, whereby our parents or our grandparents would have had to even bring drinkable water. They had to go through so many difficulties, so many struggles, to meet the standard of the family. But now, everything's ready, everything is industrialized. So it's so cheap that if something goes bad, the screen of the phone, keyboard of your laptop, I don't know, lace of your shoes, whatever the case is, throw it away. You can easily get another one. You can easily get a new one. You can easily get a better one. This culture, Sister Nahid, how much is it prevalent amongst us, and how good is it or how bad is it?
As a Gen Z member, I think this is happening between us. We are doing this. We are removing the things that are bothering us, or we feel like they are standing on our way to improvement. But the reason for it, I mean, you were mentioning that because everything is well prepared for us, we have everything available.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's because of this. I feel it's not that bad either. I mean, the young people are working. They're
mm-hmm.
working to get what they want. They are working hard for their dreams, even harder than before.
Mm-hmm.
In the time of our parents, it was like finding a job, then starting a family, and everything was...
And becoming stable.
Yeah, and then...
And now it's so many ups and downs.
Yeah, and then now you're working from morning to night, but still, you cannot find
make
men's any...
Eat, yeah.
Yeah, any places that you feel like, okay, I'm safe here. I don't have to work anymore. I don't have to be worried anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So young people are working. They are even working more than before. But this ideology, this mindset, I really like it. I mean, what is wrong with this? That these young people, these groups of society learn that if something is hurting them, okay, remove it. You don't have to be highlighting it and thinking.
So you think it's healthy?
Yeah.
You think it's healthy to have this mindset that, okay, if something's you find bad, just throw it away.
I believe
what,
that you
what
don't
what
have
if you
to
have
fight
that opportunity?
Everything.
What if you have that opportunity to fix it? What if you know that this is fixable?
So I will fix it. It's not that I'm closing my eyes and just going for removing everything from my surroundings.
You know where the conflict really arises? It's when, especially when there is this thing called time management, right? And
right.
you're always taunted by everyone around
yeah.
you, manage your time, manage your time.
Be faster.
Now, not only be faster, but, you know, spend time where it's worth it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
What if, for example, you can fix something? Like, for example, recently my water heater broke, right? And I know that I can fix it. But with the tools I have and the knowledge I have, I might fix it within 3, 4, 5 hours. But I can fix it, right? I have to go buy the parts, fix it, open the nuts, open the screws, you know, change, do the servicing, and then close it back up. It might probably... And I know that if I call someone, a technician,
right.
he might do it within an hour or even less, right?
Right.
Which one would I go for? Go for the technician or fix it myself? Or even worse, let me make the scenario much more precise. I know that if I go 5 hours, I can make maybe, let's say, an X amount of money, right? If I work for five
exactly.
hours. Yeah, this is, I think, the most conflicting issue that we are facing.
Yeah.
In 5 hours, I can make X amount of money. Right? That means I can buy a completely new water heater. Why should I waste 5 hours in fixing the old one, whereas it's worth it for me to work 5 hours and still get a better one, a newer one, one that is that does not have any problem?
Well, first, I think there is this conception, this understanding of this ideology, at least in my mind. What we mean when we say we can remove things that are bothering us, we don't mean that we have to just be blind, don't consider anything, don't think about the situation, and just, okay, problem, the solution is for it to be removed. So we have to give it a thought, kind of analyze the situation. We don't mean that this generation is not thinking about the situation. What we mean is that sometimes in toxic relationships, in the problematic situations, they don't go for the problems, for the challenges that the younger generations would have gone to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember my brother, he's older than me, and he was worried about things and just thinking about them, overthinking them a lot, while me, on the other hand, who was younger than him, I would have just removed that idea, that thing from my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have been bothering myself and just doing this rethinking thing a lot. But in the past, with the previous generations, I think because the opportunities were limited, or I don't know what the reasons were, I haven't experienced their era, but I felt they wanted to be stuck in one place, to fix it completely, to feel like there is no problem anymore, and then continue and move on. They would have stopped and paused their life.
So you believe that there is a criteria to this? There is no
yeah.
yes or no per se for this question,
yeah,
as
exactly.
should we dispose it?
Yeah,
but there is a boundary.
About.
There is a boundary
yeah.
you set.
Yeah, not
cutting,
everything
cutting
can
off
be
toxic. Exactly. So cutting off toxic relationships, you believe it should be cut off.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a toxic relationship.
Right.
You can't fix it. Cut it off. Fine. Blocking harmful content. It's a harmful content. What else do you want from it? Block it, right? Not over-investing in every argument online. it's an argument. The guy is not going to accept you. The girl is not going to accept you.
I can't understand those people who spend hours just responding
to
these kinds of
arguments. You know that there is no end to this.
Yeah.
You say, I say, you say, I say, you say, there's no end to it. Just finish it off, right? Move on. Instead of hoarding, declutter it. Whatever you have at home and you're not using it, give it away to the charity. Sell it out, whatever you can.
Yeah, maybe
declutter
there are some people who will need it.
Exactly, declutter it. You don't need it, declutter it, yeah? Choose peace over drama. You know, don't avoid such But this is like the healthy and the good aspects of it, of the disposable or thinking, right? And I think this is actually very good. And there shouldn't be... you shouldn't reach to a point whereby you say, I can't fix it, and then you say that I have to keep it still. This is, I think, not an acceptable solution.
Yeah, it's not healthy.
The boundary, basically, boundaries are not the same as disposable thinking. You set the boundaries, but
right.
This is not disposable thinking because you've set boundaries. Now, let's talk about the bad aspects of it, of this mentality
sure.
that we have in the Gen Zs and the youths of today. Maybe after taking a break. So don't go away. We're talking about this disposable thinking and the throwaway culture. But we talked about so many things about it. We said that there are boundaries. We talked about the good things about the boundaries. Let's talk about the other side after we take a break. Don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, and we are talking about avoiding things or just keep going with the things that you have or try to fix the problems, be it with the people or with the objects and things. Well, talking about the negative part, I was analyzing the people that I know and the way I myself have been acting in different situations. I know some of the youth today that are, I don't know if you have seen this group, I mean this thinking within the Gen Z members or not, but they want to be alone. They prefer to have their own solitude.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like to be in big groups. There are for sure some of the outgoing ones that
the introverts basically you're talking about.
But many of them like to be alone and prefer their own solitude to just spending time with the others.
Mm-hmm.
And once you ask them, like, why is this? Where is this coming from? I asked my cousin once that, why do you want to be alone? Why don't you want to come to the parties with us? You're just 16 years old. And then his answer was that, what if I come and someone says something and I feel unsafe?
Oh, wow.
So I think one of the reasons, one of the side effects.
It's a very common thing because they feel they feel that they're coming out of the comfort zone.
Yeah. And this fear of confrontation. They are scared, or we sometimes are scared of just facing the problems, of talking for ourselves, of stating what we think about.
So these boundaries are not necessarily the correct boundaries. Yes.
No.
We talked about the positive stuff, throwing away things that you can't fix, toxic relationships, moving on, you know, moving on from, pointless arguments. But let me challenge you with other titles, treating people like replaceable apps.
This one
doesn't work, I'll move on to the
this
next
one. This
is
not healthy.
So this also stems from the same disposable culture, but this is a negative aspect of it.
Yeah, right.
You treat people as if he's not there, if she's not there.
We can't find them again. Like, okay, my parents, how am I going to just change them with other ones?
No, I can't tell you how many youths have seen who see parents as like that. Well, they see, okay, it was their responsibility to bring me up to this point.
This is unbelievably sad.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. To be honest, you see that the culture is, especially for youths living in the West, the culture is moving on so fast.
With the materialistic world.
Thinking, being self-centric, being individualistic, and being extremely material, everything has to come with a benefit with it. With a price. And when no longer you see the benefit in that, there is no more appreciation. So yes, your parents, they're... As long as they can benefit you, there is appreciation and there is value. But then once the point they reach, and that's why in the UK that they're now opening the Ministry of Loneliness because there's so many elderly. They have kids. They had kids. They grew up. They brought up kids, but their kids are no longer looking. They probably don't even have them in the contact list
anymore.
Because
they couldn't see the benefits probably.
Yeah, so they just throw away the parents, right? replace them, like just like replacing apps. If this doesn't work, I'll use the other one.
Sad
right?
and depressing.
So this is the dark side of disposable thinking. Let me challenge you with another one. Avoiding all discomfort to repair. You know you can repair this, but then you don't feel comfortable. You can just change it. I can clearly relate to so many of my friends who have an abundance of clothes, an abundance of shoes.
And they keep them?
They keep them even, like for example, a friend of mine, a part of his clothes was torn in front of me. And then I was like, it's not something visible. You can easily just stitch it and repair it. Yeah, it's not going to take like, you know, hours from you, probably a few minutes. We were traveling together and all of a sudden he's like, this doesn't look presentable. Takes his shirts off, throws it in the bin and buys another one right there and then. And I was wordless because I was like, how could... The one aspect of it is being luxurious, having so much abundance of wealth that you can easily buy and move on. That's one aspect of it. And many people don't have that, you know, don't have that privilege, but have that wish and have that need in their inner self that, oh, I need to keep replacing, but they can't do it. And this is also very toxic. One must
and it's not accepted.
It's
like
not acceptable,
Islam,
exactly.
We are not allowed to think like this, even with our materials, even
exactly.
with the things around us. We're not allowed to... just have this throw away ideology and throw away everything that we feel, okay, there's one little problem, there is no way I can fix it.
If you can fix it, fix it. Like, this is the boundary of it. As long as you can fix it, then fix it. Even if it requires that you ask someone's help to fix that thing, ask, it's fine. There is no problem in that. And how many times that, you know... The same example of the water heater. I did spend 5 hours, by the way, fixing it, and probably even more than 5 hours because.
But it's worth it.
It was worth it, not because it was fixed, because I learned so much things.
Yeah.
I know that tomorrow, if the sparker doesn't work, if the pump doesn't work, I know exactly what's the problem.
And
I know exactly how to fix it.
And we say we are the modern citizens. So if we say that I'm learning everywhere, I'm going for my improvements,
exactly.
So this is the opportunity, go for it.
Yeah, and this is an opportunity that not everyone gets. For example, not everyone's water heater is broken for them to go fix it. Yours is broken. You have that opportunity. For you to learn how to fix, you need to go pay an agency who can open up water heaters for you and be like, this is,
right.
You know, something's wrong with it. Come diagnose it, and then they're going to teach you. But this is, you're getting it for free. Look at it as an opportunity. And I think I learned so much fixing that thing that I think that was not possible without, you know, me doing, if I would have called a technician to fix it quickly.
Yeah, now that you were talking about this experience, I was thinking of the long-term results of keeping this mindset. I mean, if there was a young person who would have just, okay, thought of buying something new and not would have thought of repairing it and going for fixing the thing. So the long-term result would be even horrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's so much more to be said. I can challenge this disposable ideology, this disposable thinking with so many more cases. And I think we'll probably discuss this in another episode.
Yeah, for sure.
There's so much more to be said, but too much less time to consider. So inshallah, in another episode, we will discuss more about this disposable culture. And until then, we bid you farewell with wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
As I pass, hoping to absorb his light into my heart. tree. I yearn the streets of my Rasul. He is my love, please let me be. Ya Muhammad, Ya Habibi, you are the light of this blessed city. Ya Muhammad, Ya Habibi, you are the light of this blessed city. Ya Muhammad, Ya Habibi, you are the light of this blessed city. Ya Muhammad, Ya Habibi, you are the light of this blessed city.
That was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days from the heart of region to the global stage. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about Donald Trump's eldest son saying his father may walk away from the Ukrainian war, and end America's support for Ukraine, as well as the latest efforts to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. Donald Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., has said his father may walk away from the Ukrainian war. He was speaking at a Middle East conference in Doha, Qatar on Sunday, 7 December. In a lengthy tirade against the purpose of continued fighting in Ukraine, Donald Trump Jr. also said Ukraine's corrupt rich had fled their country, leaving what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Trump Jr. has no formal role inside his father's administration, but is a key figure in the Make America Great Again movement. His intervention reflects the antipathy among some inside the Trump team towards the Ukrainian government, and comes as Trump's negotiating team is putting pressure on Kiev to give up territory. Trump Jr. said the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was prolonging the war because he knew he would never win an election if it ended. He also railed at the EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, saying European sanctions were not working since they had simply increased the price of oil, from which Russia could pay for its war. He described the European plan as we are going to wait for Russia to go bankrupt. That is not a plan. Asked if it was possible his father, who ran for election claiming he could bring peace to Ukraine, would simply walk away, Trump Jr. said maybe he would, adding that his father is one of the most unpredictable people in politics. He vowed that the U.S. was no longer going to be the idiot with the checkbook. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Meron Derakhshand.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, Donald Trump Jr. said Ukraine's corrupt rich had fled their country, leaving what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Tell us more about that.
Yes, he was speaking in this conference in Doha, Qatar, and he said, without providing any evidence, he said he had observed last summer in a single day in Monaco that 50% of supercars, such as Bugattis and Ferraris, had Ukrainian number plates. And he asked, do you think that was earned in Ukraine? And he said, we hear all the rumors about what is going on, and we see every license plate in Monaco is Ukrainian. Right. The rich fled their country, and they left what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Mm-hmm. there was no incentive to stop, because as long as the money train was coming and they were stealing, no one was auditing anything, so there was no reason to come to peace.
I see.
So that was his reasoning for suggesting that the rich had fled Ukraine and the poor were now fighting the war. Now, Trump's elder son also argued that Ukraine was far more corrupt than Russia. In actual fact, there have been a number of corruption scandals recently that have weakened and damaged the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky in particular. His powerful chief of staff was forced to resign because of a corruption scandal.
Trump Jr. has no formal role inside his father's administration, but he's close to his father. How seriously should we take his comments?
Yes, I think we should take his words seriously because he is close to his father. Donald Trump Jr., as you said, has no formal role in his father's administration, but he is one of the main figures in the Make America Great Again movement, the MAGA movement.
Right.
And basically, what Trump said reflects the fact that there are some within the Trump team are against the Ukrainian government in Ukraine. And Trump's negotiating team is putting pressure on Kiev to give up territory and to accept the Trump peace plan.
Right.
Trump Jr. said the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, was prolonging the war because he knew he would never win an election if the war ended.
Right.
And I think we should take Donald Trump Jr.'s words seriously because he is close to his father.
Yeah.
And there are other indications that Trump's patience with Volodymyr Zelensky and other members of the Ukrainian government is running thin. Donald Trump had threatened in the past that if he felt the Ukrainians were dragging their feet or were disinterested in peace, he would simply walk away and cut off Ukraine's support and let the Ukrainians fight it out with the Russians. So he said that on other occasions in the past. So I think we should take the words of Donald Trump Jr. seriously. Right.
Trump has said Volodymyr Zelensky isn't ready to sign off on a U.S.-authored peace proposal aimed at ending the war between Russia and Ukraine. What is the latest on that?
Yes, the latest is that Donald Trump has said Zelensky isn't ready to sign off on his peace proposal, and there have been 3 days of negotiations between a Ukrainian delegation and the Trump administration in Florida, in Mar-a-Lago, Florida. Trump said, I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people loved it, he said, but he hasn't read it. Now, days of negotiations between U.S. and Ukrainian officials ended in Florida on Saturday. And Zelensky, of course, met with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and Germany's chancellor, Friedrich Merz, on Monday, 8th of December, and Starmer has repeatedly stressed that Ukraine must determine its own future and said a European peacekeeping force would play a vital role in guaranteeing Ukraine's security. But the fact that Donald Trump, of course, tried to bring peace to Gaza, and the U.S. is now working to push through a peace plan between Ukraine and Russia, U.S. officials claim that they're in the final stages of reaching an agreement between Ukraine and Russia, but there is little sign that either the Ukrainians or the Russians are willing to sign up to Donald Trump's peace plan.
Right.
Trump has said, Russia is, I believe, fine with the peace deal, but I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it.
Yeah.
His people love it, but Zelensky isn't ready. Well, as far as I can say, Trump has had a hot and cold relationship with Zelensky, on-again, off-again relationship with Volodymyr Zelensky, and has repeatedly urged the Ukrainians to cede land to Russia in order to bring the conflict to an end.
Right.
And Trump has said this war has already cost far too many lives. Now, Zelensky said last Saturday that he had a substantive phone call with his officials in Florida who were negotiating with the Trump administration. He said he had been given an update over the phone by both U.S. and Ukrainian officials who were involved in the peace talks in Florida. Mm-hmm. So that's the latest on that.
I see. In its new national security strategy published overnight on Saturday, the White House said it was committed to Ukraine's survival as a viable state. But the strategy also prioritized improving relations with Moscow. Tell us more about that.
Yes, the U.S. national security strategy has alarmed European leaders, but it has been welcomed by Russia. For example, Dmitry Peskov, Kremlin spokesman, said the new U.S. national security strategy spells out the Trump administration's core foreign policy interests, and it was largely in line with Moscow's vision, he said.
Right.
The document released by the White House said that U.S. wanted to improve its relations with Russia after years of Moscow being treated as effectively a pariah state, and U.S. also wants to end the war between Russia and Ukraine, and this was a core U.S. interest, it said, to end the war, to reestablish strategic stability with Russia.
Right.
This new U.S. national security strategy, this new document also said that NATO must not be a perpetually expanding alliance. And this is another point that the Russians have been complaining about, that NATO keeps continually expanding. So it also made a point about migration and free speech in Europe, suggesting that the Europeans face the prospect of civilizational erasure because of migration to Europe. Now, the Europeans have been rather annoyed by that suggestion. They're saying that this is direct interference in European affairs by the Trump administration, so the Europeans haven't taken kindly to that.
Mm-hmm.
And we can say that despite efforts by Donald Trump and his team to push through a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine, so far it seems that we're still some way off from actually signing a peace deal.
Right. Listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. Russia has welcomed the Trump administration's new national security strategy. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said the updated strategic document, which spells out the administration's core foreign policy interests, was largely in line with Moscow's vision. Can you expand that for us?
Yes, Peskov actually praised Donald Trump's latest national security strategy, calling it encouraging. It's an encouraging change of policy in Washington that largely aligns with Moscow's thinking. So this document was published or released on Saturday, and it criticizes the European Union, saying Europe is at risk of civilizational erasure. And it says that the United States is keen to establish better relations with Russia.
Right.
So as Peskov said, the Trump administration was in favor of dialogue and building good relations with Moscow. But Peskov also warned that the U.S. deep state could try to sabotage Donald Trump's vision, which was spelled out in this new national security strategy.
Yeah. What about Europe? What is the European position on Donald Trump's peace plan for Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Europeans are generally skeptical and rather wary of Donald Trump's peace plan for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
European leaders want to show their solidarity with Ukraine as the White House pressures Kiev to accept a peace deal with Russia. For example, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer insisted that he won't be putting pressure on Volodymyr Zelensky to accept a peace settlement, unlike the Americans. And the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz expressed skepticism about Donald Trump's peace proposal.
I see.
And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has previously called on his European allies for support at times when the White House has tried to push Ukraine towards agreeing to give up territory.
Mm-hmm.
So a key issue for Kiev is what security guarantees it would receive if it does agree to renounce control over some territory. particularly in the east of the country, it is not clear that either the United States or Europe are willing to offer the kind of security guarantees that would genuinely deter Russia from attacking Ukraine. And we can also say that U.S. officials have claimed to be close to a sustainable peace deal between Russia and Ukraine on a number of occasions in the past, and particularly since Donald Trump began his second term in office. But all these occasions, it turned out that this was just wishful thinking on the part of Trump administration officials. The Europeans generally view peace in Ukraine as being a distant prospect. That's how they really view it, as a distant prospect. And they think quite a lot of work needs to be done before we actually get to peace in Ukraine. Now, Donald Trump's outgoing Ukraine envoy, Keith Kellogg, said at a Middle East defense forum on Saturday that the Trump administration's efforts to end the war in Ukraine were in their last 10 meters, he said. And according to Keith Kellogg, Donald Trump's Ukraine envoy, there were two outstanding issues in the peace talks. One was about territory, the territory which the Russians had captured in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And the other was the fate of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. So those two issues were still unresolved.
Right. To sum up very briefly then, the comments by Donald Trump's eldest son should be taken seriously since he is close to his father. And Trump himself had indicated in the past that his patience was running thin with the Ukrainians because they were dragging their feet or wasting time and they didn't seem to be interested in peace. Thank you, Mr. Rashander, for your insightful analysis.
Thanks for inviting me.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.